The Spiritual Man, 1 Corinthians 2, the first talk in a series entitled Being a Spiritual Person, was presented by Ron Julian on September 26, 2006, at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This recording may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My concern in this class is to try to understand the biblical concept of spirituality. I would assert that the Bible has some very specific things to say about what being a spiritual person is all about, and I'm going to try to talk about how I understand that biblical picture. As we're going to see, spirituality can be talked about from two different perspectives, because in the first place, the biblical picture of spirituality is talking about a work of the Spirit of God. Spirituality is something that the Holy Spirit is bringing about in the lives of God's people. And we can talk about it from that perspective, and we will talk about it from that perspective. From another perspective, spirituality is also about how we choose to live as believers. There is an aspect to the biblical discussion about spirituality that calls upon us to respond in a certain way. And we will talk about that as well. Probably that's the bulk of what we will be talking about. So some of the kinds of questions we're going to explore, what is the work of the Holy Spirit? What is the biblical picture of the spiritual life, the Christian life? Are some of us missing out? Are there techniques or disciplines that could win for us a higher level of spirituality? What is the role of things like prayer and Bible study? Those are the things that I hope we will have, I am planning to talk about in the coming weeks. I want to start with a personal comment so that you understand where I'm coming from a little bit and the sort of thing that you're about to be involved in. And, you know, I can give you an out quickly that's not what I want. These issues have been important issues to me in my life as a Christian. There are many schools of thought on these topics. You will find in the church whole movements, theological movements and denominations and groups that are formed around a particular picture of spirituality and what it is you're supposed to be doing. And they're not all necessarily compatible. There are different pictures out there of what it's exactly supposed to be. Part of the reason, one of the main reasons I became a student of the Bible is because I felt confused by all those various pictures. I was in a particular tradition. I was taught a particular model of spirituality, and I didn't find that model particularly satisfying or workable as a Christian, and I didn't quite know what to do. Maybe the problem is with me. Maybe I just haven't figured out how to do this thing yet. Maybe the problem is with what I'm being told. Maybe the picture is something different. And the early years of my Christian experience, after becoming a believer at 18, I was an atheist and then became a believer at 18. My first 5-7 years or something like that as a believer were filled with questions and struggle and trying to figure out what the heck this was all about. In the process, in becoming a student of the Bible and becoming involved with the people that I became involved with, some of them who are here and still, I'm still involved with, in the process, I became deeply committed to what you might call exegetical theology. And what I mean by that is, let's start with trying to understand particular passages and books of the Bible. If I'm reading Paul and he's talking about spirituality, I have to try to start by putting aside, I want Paul to answer my questions right now and actually get in there and think about what is he concerned with? What was the problem in the Galatian region that he was speaking to? What is the issue for them? And then when I have understood what the issue was for them, I'm going to see truths that come from Paul's deep understanding of the gospel through the inspiration of the Spirit at work in making him an apostle. I'm going to see the principles, the way he looked at life, and those things are going to inform my picture of things. So that's what I do, and that's what we're going to do in this class, is you may find at times, hey, I came here to talk about spirituality, and you're talking about these people that were dead 2,000 years ago and how they couldn't get along with each other, and why should I care about that? Well, that's what I do. That's what I'm interested in, is trying to have as confident an understanding as I can of what it was that Paul was getting at, so that I feel like I have some sort of foundation on which to stand. Over the years, in the process of doing this, I have found myself at odds with a number of those traditions that I was talking about, those spiritual traditions about what the spiritual life looks like. And those of you who know me know that I am not far from a coward. I'd like to say that I am not a coward, but I'm close enough to be within walking distance. And I don't particularly like controversy. I don't like being the guy who disagrees with everybody and all that kind of stuff. But I have found myself in the position where, basically, by the time this class is done, you will have seen me disagreeing with this famous person and their school of thought and another famous school of thought and another famous school of thought. And you'll get the impression that I'm just a very cranky old man who disagrees with everybody. I am a cranky old man, but the reason that I disagree with these people is not because I'm a cranky old man, but because I don't find the picture of the Bible that they're painting convincing. There are kind of two ways to go about this. You can look at the theology and say, which of these theologies do I like? And there can be, sometimes that can do all right for you, but the problem is, the real question is, which of these theologies is actually true? Which of them actually represents what the Bible's saying? And what I'm trying to do here is show you something of how I've thought about this question and why I would think that we should think about these issues in one way and not another. So, that's my warning. You will come away from here with a certain knowledge of the things that I don't agree with. But my primary goal is not to disagree with people, but to paint a positive picture of what I think biblical spirituality is about. And then my last warning for tonight is really sort of an introduction to what I plan on doing. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to look at a passage in 1 Corinthians, the second chapter of 1 Corinthians. And in order to look at this passage, it's going to involve us stepping back into the situation, talking about what's going on in Corinth and all of that sort of thing. And you may wonder what happened to our topic. But the reason we're going to look at those things is because in the end, I think this chapter is going to give us a good framework from which to work, and we will actually come back and be referring to this passage a number of times throughout this series. So if in the next few minutes you start to wonder what happened to the topic that I came here to talk about, I'd just like you to trust me that ultimately this series is going to be about spirituality and biblical spirituality, but I have some things I want to do to get us ready for that. So that's what we're going to do tonight. So, 1 Corinthians chapter 2. First of all, I want to make some comments about the interpretation of this passage. What is going on in this passage, and how should we understand some ambiguous phrases in here? What's happening? And then we'll come back and talk about the significance of it. Okay, so, take a deep breath. We find ourselves now back in Corinth. Paul founds a church in Corinth. He goes there. He proclaims the gospel. A church grows up around his teaching of the gospel. And he was there in Corinth for about a year and a half. And while he was there, obviously he got to know a lot of people. The church was built up. You have this group of believers meeting together in Corinth. And then Paul leaves after a year and a half. And after he leaves, a guy named Apollos comes to Corinth. Apollos is a new convert. He has been a believer, a man who believed in God and who came to believe that Jesus was the Messiah, but he didn't have a lot of specific understanding about some things involving Jesus. He was instructed in those things, and then he went to Corinth, and Acts tells us he was a very big help in the church. It Acts also tells us that Apollos was a very eloquent man, and in particular, he was a powerful debater. He was very good at taking on the Jews and showing from the Old Testament that Jesus was the Messiah and that he fit the prophecies and all of that sort of thing. And he was very popular in Corinth. People liked him, and he was very helpful, at least for a while. He was very helpful in Corinth from his understanding and his ability to speak eloquently and to debate and so on. The problem is that what started to happen is that a number of people in Corinth decided that they liked Apollos better than they liked Paul. Apollos was this eloquent man. They came to think that Paul was not. He was a poor speaker, and they found something lacking in what he was doing. He did not speak what they would call wisdom, and we need to see that as kind of a technical term. They had this concept that they called wisdom. And it's a little bit hard to capture what goes into that. Partly it has to do with style, with eloquence. It has to do with the impact you have on your audience, I think. The idea that the audience comes away convinced that you are hot. You are a great speaker. You are carrying the day. I'm persuaded by what you're saying. If you have the skills of rhetoric such that you sway the crowd, then you have this wisdom. So it's not just a matter of style, it's partly a matter of content. Do you have the goods that are really going to make people sit up and say, yeah, that's the guy? I picture the situation as something like this. When you put together the picture from 1 and 2 Corinthians, the opponents of Paul are saying, well, look, Paul, I have this friend who's a big shot in Corinth, but I can't bring him to hear you. You're kind of embarrassing. I mean, you know, we come to hear you, and you're just kind of talking about the cross and all of this kind of stuff. And that's fine, you know, we're Christians and everything, but this is not what they came to hear. This is not the way you're going to sell this to this crowd. You need to speak with wisdom. You know, when I bring my friend to listen to Apollos, and he's debating the Jews, and he's knocking them over right and left, he goes away and says, wow, that guy's pretty impressive. I bring him to hear you, and he goes, is this over yet? You know, can we go home? So the group in Corinth that had set themselves as, we like Apollos and we don't like Paul, they were dealing largely with this issue of Paul and his lack of so-called wisdom in the way that he taught and spoke. And basically, in the first like five chapters of 1 Corinthians, the brunt of Paul's message is, the problem here is not with my speaking style. The problem is that you find the gospel itself embarrassing. Basically, I have no interest in speaking what you call wisdom. Because in order to make my message palatable to the large crowd so that everybody would say, wow, that's hot stuff, I would have to change it. I would have to make it something that people found more attractive than the message of the gospel itself. But I don't want to do that. That's not what I'm called to do. What I'm called to do is say it the way it is, and there are going to be those who will see the wisdom in it, and there are going to be those who do not see the wisdom in it. But it's not my job to become the sort of speaker that sways the crowd, because the way you sway the crowd is by telling them what they want to hear, and I'm not going to do that. So that's roughly, I think, the kind of issue that we find here. So the issue in chapter 2, we're in the middle of this discussion, and the issue is how Paul speaks and whether he speaks with what they call wisdom. Okay? So you're going to find me going really fast through this. There's all kinds of stuff to say in these chapters, and I'm not going to talk about a lot of it. But I just want to kind of paint an overall picture here. Starting chapter 2, and when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. There's a lot that could be talked about there, but I just want to emphasize what he's saying is, when I came to you, when I came and founded that church, I had no intention to speak with what you call wisdom. You're thinking back to when I was there. Paul's not there right now, but you're thinking back to when I was there and saying, you know, compared to Apollos, Paul just does not have what we're looking for. And what he's saying here is, I had never intended to speak in the way that you're accusing that I didn't speak. I don't care that I didn't speak that way. That was not what I set out to do. And there's a lot more that we could talk about there, but we'll just leave it at that. He goes on, yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. A wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away, but we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory, the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. Okay, now there's a couple of things I want to say here. We have this, we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. We're turning to a different picture of wisdom now. There is a wisdom that you think I should be speaking, and it was never my intention to speak that. But there is a different kind of wisdom, and I will lay claim to that. And that's what he's about to say. Now, there's an important point of interpretation I want to make here. I don't have the time tonight to fully defend this, but I could do it so if I were called upon to do so. But it may seem like a little thing, but it's actually very important. Paul says, yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. And the question is, who is we? Our tendency as Christians when we read the Bible is to, if we come across we in that statement, we're thinking, well, that must mean Christians, we Christians. And so we can take everything that Paul says here as being about we Christians. So we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, and we speak wisdom among those who are mature. That must be a statement of the Christian life. We speak wisdom among those who are mature. Well, I would argue that that's not what's happening, that when Paul says we, he basically means himself. And I could show you, I wrote up a list once. There's all these places in the New Testament where Paul uses the word we with the kind of the royal we, you know, to refer to himself. And he will be talking about I, and then he will switch to we. But it's very clear that by we, he means himself. Why he does it, I don't know. There are different explanations he could give, but he does do it, and he does it often. So I would argue in this situation, remember the context. What's the issue? Paul is being accused of speaking without wisdom. So when he says, yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, this is his answer. It was not my intention to speak this wisdom that you're looking for when I came among you, but I do speak wisdom. Among the mature, there is something that I would lay claim to. I would call it wisdom. It's not what you would call wisdom, but it's what I would call wisdom, and I do speak with wisdom. That's what this section is going to be about, and the we that we find all through this is Paul talking about himself as an apostle and how he speaks, how he teaches. So that's going to be important, I think, as we try to sort out some of these issues of spirituality as we come along here. I would argue, I'm maintaining, that this is Paul talking about how he speaks, because it's his speech that is under attack. Okay. This is not the kind of wisdom that the movers and shakers of this world find compelling, unlike what the Corinthians want him to speak, the sort of thing that the movers and shakers would say, wow, that's really great. Paul says, look, the wisdom I'm talking about, this is the kind of wisdom that when Jesus came, the embodiment of God's wisdom, the movers and shakers looked at him and said, let's kill him. So this is not the sort of wisdom that is going to be compelling to the big names, the people of this world. It's the sort of wisdom that the people of this world may very well look at and say, that's not wisdom at all. But it's straight from God. It is the hidden wisdom. It is what God knows about his purposes and what is valuable and what is good and what he intends to do in the world. This is the wisdom that Paul is speaking, the wisdom that God himself gives. But who is this guy Paul? I mean, why could this guy Paul be laying claim to being to be speaking the hidden wisdom of God? You know, to be saying, I'm telling you what God thinks. I'm telling you what God intends to do. Why would he claim that he could do such a thing? Well, he goes on in verse 10. For to us, God revealed them through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, explaining spiritual truths to spiritual people. Now, this is where it becomes important to keep track of who we is in this discussion. It's quite common for people to read this and see Paul as saying that the Spirit of God is whispering things to us inside. We have received the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, as if somehow the Spirit has come in and I didn't even need the Bible. I just have inner direct revelation from God to tell me whatever it is that God wants to tell me. Well, we could talk about whether that's in fact something that the Bible teaches, but what I would say that it is not something that the Bible teaches here, because that's not what Paul's talking about. He's talking about himself as an apostle. He's defending himself against the charge that he does not teach wisdom. But what he's saying is, he speaks a wisdom directly from God. How can that be? Well, the Spirit of God knows the mind of God. Who knows what God is thinking and planning and intending? The Spirit of God knows that. And the Spirit of God is revealing these things to Paul. One of the common themes in Paul's letter, because he often had to defend himself in many of the letters that he wrote, he had to defend himself in one way or another. And one of the common themes at the beginning of his letters is to say, I didn't make this up. I mean, in essence, he never puts it that way, but in essence what he's saying is, I didn't make this up. I got this from Jesus. I got this from the Spirit of God. What I'm telling you is what I have been told. So I think it's pretty clear that that's what Paul is doing here. He's saying, you want to know why I can lay claim to be teaching wisdom? Because the Spirit of God, who knows the mind of God, has taught me. And I understand, I know some things about who God is and what he is intending to do and the significance of the gospel and who Jesus is and what that means for our eternal destiny. And I know those things because I've been taught them and I'm ready to pass them on. And then after the Spirit gives Paul understanding, then Paul speaks what he has learned from the Spirit. And remember, the issue here is, how does Paul speak? Is he speaking wisdom or not? And what he's saying is, well, after having been taught by the Spirit of God, I speak what I have learned. Now, in verse 13, we have a very tricky but important phrase. I hate to take us into really tricky territory, but the fact is that this is kind of important to our theme. This is where we're going to start to see our theme emerge a little bit. So I want to talk about it. It's this phrase. I don't know what translation you have. In the New American Standard, it reads, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. Okay, now, I'm just briefly throw a little Greek at you here. You need to know that the word thoughts and the word words are not in the text. When it says combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words, thoughts and words, those aren't in there at all. All we have is three words. We have a verb, which the New American Standard has translated as combining. And then we have the word spirituals. And then we have the word spirituals. So we have basically verb, which the New American Standard translated as combining spirituals. That's what we have. Okay. And we could talk about the cases, but we'll just leave it at that for right now. We've got that. Now, we have another problem as well. that the word that they've translated combining, sometimes that's what it means, but sometimes that's not what it means. It's one of those words that can be used in a variety of ways. And one of the meanings that it has is to interpret or explain. So instead of, I think the New American Standard has missed it in this point. Instead of translating it as combining spirituals with spirituals, which is what they're doing. And then what are the spirituals? Well, I guess it must be thoughts and words, spiritual thoughts and spiritual words. That's what they've done. They haven't done wrong to try to put words in there to fill it out. You have to put something in to try to make sense of what Paul's saying. But I think that the Revised Standard actually did a much better job with this. They went in the direction that I would go. They translated it, interpreting spiritual truths to those who possess the Spirit. And I translated it, explaining spiritual truths to spiritual people. So it's explaining spirituals to spirituals is the phrase that I would say. And the first spirituals is spiritual things, the things of the Spirit, and the second one is spiritual people. Explaining spiritual things to spiritual people, I think, is what Paul is getting at. And if that's right, and I think it is, then we're coming close to our theme here, because Paul is speaking, he says, to spiritual people. And that's our topic, spiritual people. So here we see a first glimmer of what the Bible might have to say about such a thing. What is a spiritual person? The truths Paul teaches are spiritual. We've already seen him talking about that. Why are they spiritual things that he teaches? Because they are things that have been revealed to him by the Spirit. They are the truths imparted by the Spirit. So he explains spiritual things, the things that have been imparted by the Spirit. But why is it then that the people are spiritual? What is it about them that's spiritual? His words are spiritual because they're taught by the Spirit, revealed by the Spirit. But why is it that it is spiritual people that he's talking to? Well, he goes on, I think, to make it clear what he has in mind. But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them, because they are spiritually evaluated. But he who is spiritual rightly evaluates all things, yet he himself is rightly evaluated by no man. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him, but we have the mind of Christ? Okay, so we have this distinction here between the natural man and the spiritual man. Paul just got done saying, my task is to interpret, explain spiritual things, the things that have been revealed to me by the Spirit, to spiritual people. And now we're going to see what the significance of being a spiritual person is. The natural man, I would say, as Paul is laying it out here, is what we are in ourselves, apart from the intervention of God. Man in his hostility to the truth. Man who looks at the cross and says, that's not for me, that's not interesting, there are a lot more powerful and important things that I could be involved with. He cannot rightly evaluate the wisdom of God. He looks at what God would say is wisdom and says, well, that might be interesting, but actually I've got other things that I'm more interested in. Whereas the spiritual man, as Paul describes him, is the one in whom the Spirit of God has intervened, giving him eyes to see and ears to hear. The spiritual person is the one who rightly evaluates things. It is the person who sees the truth and says, that's the truth. The person who sees wisdom, true wisdom from God, and says, that's wisdom from God. That's the spiritual person. The spiritual person is the one who can rightly evaluate. And not only can he rightly evaluate, but the turn on that is, at the same time, the spiritual person is not rightly evaluated by others, he's saying. And in particular, I think he means by the natural man. The natural man doesn't see the wisdom of the gospel. But the spiritual person, the one in whom the Spirit of God is at work, can rightly evaluate the truths of God. And yet, that person is not going to be rightly evaluated by their natural man. The natural man is going to look at them and say, you know, I think he's kind of a fool. He shouldn't be doing that. That's not the way to go. And I think that there is a reason that Paul brings this up at this point, because he himself has been criticized by the Corinthians as being as lacking wisdom in his speech. And so this is a little bit of a warning to them. Paul's saying it's the natural man who can't understand the spiritual man. The one who sees the value of the gospel is not understood by those who in whom the Spirit is not at work. So one of the ramifications of that is Paul, the preacher of the gospel, the one who is proclaiming the wisdom from God, is being evaluated wrongly by the Corinthians. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. What's the wisdom of man?
Okay, I'll say a word about that. Maybe we can talk more about that afterwards. You have to step back. From my perspective, when the word wisdom is used, wisdom can apply to a lot of different things. Wisdom involves, it's like being savvy. You know, I get it. I know how things work. I understand what it takes. So human beings have a lot of wisdom about a lot of things in life. There are people who, they know how people tick. You know, I can be a great salesman because I know what gets people to sign on the dotted line and that sort of thing. So the wisdom of man is that which the natural man would say, yeah, in my experience, that's wise. That's the smart stuff. That's the way to do it. And the wisdom of the gospel, the wisdom of God, as Paul talks about in the first chapter, there is this tension there that the world sees the wisdom of the gospel as foolishness. And Paul is saying there, though, you know, God doesn't care. He's not at all concerned that the world looks at the gospel and says, that's foolish. Because God would look at them back and say, what you call wisdom is going to lead to nothing. You haven't even come to know me through your wisdom, and I'm the guy who made you. So it can't be that wise if you haven't even arrived at an understanding of who I am. Okay, so Paul wraps up then by returning to the theme of the hidden truths of God, this language about who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him. He's echoing language from the Old Testament. And it's one of those taunts that God would give to us. Who are you to think that you know what I'm thinking? But what Paul is doing here is he's quoting that as to say, yeah, okay, I recognize that there's a certain audacity in claiming to know the mind of God. Nonetheless, I do. The fact is that the Spirit of God has revealed to me what it is that Christ is thinking and doing in the world. So I would argue that that phrase, we have the mind of Christ, which is a very popular phrase in many Christian circles to describe somehow I have been given Christ's mind and I can think the way he does or something. We can talk about what that, there may be some truth to that in a certain sense, but that's not what Paul's saying. We have the mind of Christ is his statement in response. I know it's audacious to claim that someone knows the mind of God, but I do. That's why my message is wisdom, because I have the mind of Christ. I have been given from Christ himself and the Spirit of Christ, I have been given an understanding of what this is all about. Okay, so let me give you a very broad paraphrase of what I think Paul's saying here. This is very broad, and then I want to talk to you about why I brought this up. What does this have to do with our topic? My broad paraphrase, something like this. I know you Corinthians want me to speak what you call wisdom. You want your influential friends to come hear me and say to you, wow, you hang out with really powerful and persuasive people. But the problem is this. The gospel will never be persuasive to the people of this world. I have no intention of trying to turn the gospel into what the world thinks is wisdom. The gospel already is wisdom. The gospel is God revealing his hidden purposes to his elect. What wisdom could be greater than that? God, through his Spirit, has revealed his eternal purposes to me, Paul, an apostle, and my task is to proclaim those truths revealed by the Spirit. But the Spirit has a role to play in my hearers as well, in you. It is those who are spiritual, those in whom the Spirit is at work, that will understand the wisdom and value of the gospel. The natural man will never get it. The natural man and the spiritual man hear the same gospel, and yet the natural man sees it as folly, while the spiritual man sees it as wisdom and life. I know this is an audacious claim. Who can claim to know the mind of God? But as an apostle, that is exactly what I have come to know. Christ has revealed his understanding to me. Okay, so that's roughly what I think Paul has said in chapter 2. Now, let me talk to you about why I wanted to talk about this passage and what it has to do with our topic. You probably have some idea already. But there are some highly important themes in this passage that are going to come up again and again as we explore here in the coming weeks this topic of spirituality. First, the distinction between the natural and the spiritual. We will explore this further in the coming weeks, and I'll make more of a defense of this idea. But Paul here sees the spiritual as that which has been transformed by the Spirit of God. In our culture, we are inclined to think of spirituality as like, it's like a sensitivity to aesthetically pleasing things, or if I wander in a garden and I feel like I'm in the presence of God because of the flowers, I'm a more spiritual person. Now, I'm not knocking that. I think feeling like you're in the presence of God in the garden is a great thing to do. I'm not saying you shouldn't be doing that or anything like that. I'm not saying that you should be doing that either. That's something that, I mean, it can happen. Maybe it's not going to happen. That's a negotiable issue there. But that's not spirituality. That's not what the Bible is talking about as spirituality, as being, you know, open to the possibility of that there are spirits around, or, I mean, all kinds of things that get associated with the idea of spirituality. From the Bible's perspective, the spiritual is that which is brought about by the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God is at work to accomplish something. The things that the Spirit taught Paul are the spiritual truths, and the people in whom the Spirit is at work are the spiritual people. So that's something that we're going to need to understand very much if we're going to build a biblical concept of spirituality. It is the work of the Spirit that we're talking about here. And so we'll try to explore this distinction more between the natural and the spiritual and exactly what the Bible is getting at there. Secondly, there are qualities that result from being a spiritual person. And we saw a crucial one in this passage: eyes to see. The ability to evaluate the truth. I mean, if you just think of becoming a Christian as, well, you hear the gospel and you say, okay, and then you go to heaven, maybe it doesn't seem like such a big deal. But if you think about the world as this battlefield where the forces of evil are trying to darken and cloud the minds of the people of this world, and our goal is to actually break through and see what's true, to actually overcome our own inertia and hostility to God, to admit that we're sinners when we don't want to admit that we're sinners, to admit that we can't save ourselves when we would like to think that we can, to admit that this world is actually not going to solve our problem when we would like to think if we can just get enough stuff it will solve our problem, to overcome those barriers and actually see the wisdom of the gospel for what it is a profound thing to have happen. And that's what Paul is talking about in this passage. The spiritual person is the one who gets it, the one who can look at the world and see what's important and what's valuable. And that's a theme we're going to explore quite a bit, and that's something that comes out of this passage. Third, there is this distinction that I didn't highlight too much, but now I want to, between a universal and individual sort of spirituality. And here's what I'm getting at. I said at the beginning that Paul is describing the Spirit as having inspired him with an understanding of the gospel. The Spirit has revealed to him the things of God. That's because he's an apostle. Paul has a lot to say about the gift that God has given him, the work of the Spirit in his life, which is different than the work of the Spirit in other people's life. He is an apostle. He has had revelation. He has been prepared to do this job in a way that other people have not. I am not an apostle. You're not an apostle, I would argue. Paul was an apostle. We're not. The Spirit of God was doing something in him that he's not doing in us. And yet, at the same time, Paul immediately goes on to talk about the spiritual people. And there he's talking about a universal work of the Spirit, something that in every believer, everyone who can look at the gospel and say, amen to that, that is a work of the Spirit of God that the Spirit is doing in every one of God's people without exception. So there is a universal aspect to spirituality, something that is common to Christian experience and a necessary part of all Christian experience. And then there is a particular individual work of the Spirit that differs from person to person. And one of the things we will do is look at the classic passage that talks about that distinction, which is 1 Corinthians chapter 12, talking about spiritual gifts and that sort of thing, trying to understand the difference between those things that are in common among us all and those things that differ among us in terms of our expression of the work of the Spirit in our lives. So that distinction we see in this passage, and that's going to be very important as we go through in the weeks to come. And finally, the fourth theme in this passage actually can be seen better in the next verses. If we go on, and let me just read a few more verses into chapter 3 of 1 Corinthians. Paul says, after all of that stuff that we were looking at, "And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual men, but as to men of flesh, as to babes in Christ. I gave you milk to drink, not solid food, for you were not yet able to receive it. Indeed, even now you are not yet able, for you are still fleshly. For since there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not fleshly, and are you not walking like mere men? For when one says, 'I am of Paul,' and another, 'I am of Apollos,' are you not mere men?" Now, this is a famous little passage here because there are whole theological movements that are founded on that thing that I just read there. Because there's this problem that we encounter as we read that. Paul is writing to Christians, right? These are Christians in Corinth that he's writing to. And yet he says, I couldn't speak to you as to spiritual people. You're still fleshly. And yet these are Christians that he's talking to. So he seems to be suggesting, isn't he, that there's this kind of hierarchy. There is a fleshly kind of way to be a Christian, and then there's the spiritual way to be a Christian. And he would advocate to them that they stop being fleshly Christians and start being spiritual Christians. Well, this raises this question then. What does that mean? And what does that say to us about the spiritual life? Is there a hierarchy to the spiritual life? Is there something that you need to do to move from the lower rung to the upper rung? And we will probably have a chance to talk as we go along about some of the major theological movements that have answered that question in one way or another, about how you move from the lower rung to the upper rung. And that's a topic that we want to talk about a lot in this class as well, not just the upper rung and lower rung thing, but basically the whole question of, what does it mean to live out a spiritual life? Paul is talking to people about how he speaks to spiritual people, but then as he describes the strife and bitterness and the factions that are between them, it's clear that he doesn't think that the way they are conducting themselves is in line with what he would see as spirituality. So what does that mean? What is it that we are called upon to do? Clearly there's something wrong here in Corinth. What's the solution to the problem? What is it that he would say we need to do in response to this? What does being a spiritual person look like? Are there disciplines that will get me there? Are there techniques of prayer that will get me there? Are there means of grace that will get me there? What exactly is it that's going to make the difference here? Or is Paul getting at something else entirely different? That's going to be a big part of what we want to talk about here, is what does it look like to be a spiritual person? And in doing that, I want to talk specifically about some of the usual candidates. I want to talk some about prayer and what the Bible has to say to us about essentially what sort of a thing prayer is. What role is it meant to play in our lives? I want to talk about Bible study. I will have one session where I talk about Bible study. And that one is going to be a little different than the rest of the sessions, because my purpose there, well, you'll see when we get there. But let me just say that as a community that puts a lot of emphasis on the Bible, I still think that among the community, among those people who find what we have to say around here interesting and to listen to it, I think there's still some confusion about, you know, that's great, you guys get up there and study the Bible and do all that stuff, that's great, but what place is the Bible supposed to have in my life personally? What am I supposed to do with it? And I feel like I would like, as a part of this, to kind of make not the official McKinsey Study Center proclamation, but my own personal proclamation as to what would I say to that question? What place should the Bible have in the life of every single believer? What is it that the Bible is supposed to be doing for us? I felt like that was an important topic to take on, so that's one of the things we're looking at. But a number of those things will come together to look at what will be the bulk of what we do. Most of the sessions are going to be in one way or another about how shall we then live? What does a spiritual existence look like? What am I called upon to do? How does spiritual growth happen? Spiritual formation is a big topic these days, and in a lot of ways, the bulk of what we're going to be talking about is that issue, spiritual formation and how it comes about. But I think our discussion of those things has to be built on this foundation of a basic sense of what biblical spirituality is getting at. So for the first several weeks, I'm going to be trying to lay that foundation, and then we'll get into specifics as we go along. Okay, well, that's what I have to say tonight. So just kind of laying a little groundwork, and we'll get hot and heavy next week, I guess. This is your opportunity to ask any questions or make any comments. Yes, John.
You said that Paul was talking about a different kind of wisdom in this passage, and that the word wisdom was coming up quite a bit, and that was part of the context of this passage.
Right.
Would you be willing to define wisdom as perhaps Paul in differentiating from the way the Corinthians were understanding and utilizing that, just as a definition of the word and how it's being used?
Okay. Well, in one sense, I think they would have the same definition in that there is an element to it of wisdom is that which represents good understanding. I have the skill, you know, if you listen to this, you're going to learn what you need to know to deal successfully with life and that sort of thing. And I think that would be in common between them. Where the difference is Paul would see a message about a Messiah who dies a horrible death on a cross as being a message of comfort and of life and of power. That this message of Jesus dying on a cross, when you understand what our problem is and what God is doing for us, that this is a message, it is wise because it is leading me to life. If I embrace the truth of this, I'm going to find myself escaping my own guilt before God and being welcomed by Him instead. I'm going to escape death and have eternal life. I'm going to escape condemnation. I'm going to escape futility in this life and enter into the fullness of what God intends for His creation. I mean, all of that is wrapped up in this message of the gospel. But for the Corinthians, a message that has wisdom. The problem is that some of those topics, talking to someone about how they needed a Savior to die on a cross, that's only interesting if you're really ready to take on the significance of the problem of your own evil. But since that's not one of those things that by nature we want to admit or own up to, I would instead rather hear a message, how about a motivating message that tells me that if you do these three things, you will achieve wealth and power and significance. Now, that would be a message that would be wise, because that'll get you something. You listen to this and you take it on and you get this wealth and power and significance, and now you'll have gotten something worthwhile. That Christian stuff, I mean, that's nice and everything, but that's when it comes down to it, it's not really very relevant. So the difference between their two conceptions of wisdom, it really is arises from the picture of what is really true about the world and thus what is most relevant in it. You know, if it makes all the difference if, you know, I'm sitting in a nice lounge and the sun is shining on me and I'm drinking a nice drink, that might be the most relevant thing, is I've gotten myself to a wonderful situation where I'm sitting here resting in the sun and relaxing and enjoying a wonderful drink. But the most relevant thing might be that I'm on the Titanic while I'm doing it. And it all depends on how you see your context. So what seems like wisdom when you're sitting on a deck chair drinking a nice drink might not look like wisdom once you figure out what it means that you're on the Titanic, I guess is what I'm saying. And that's the difference between them, is what's going to strike you as wise depends on what you think is going on. And the Corinthians, they just haven't understood that you have to make this choice. They want to have it both ways. Yeah, we believe in Jesus, but we want to believe in a Jesus that gives us the kind of message that the world is going to stand up and say, boy, that's got to be it. And Paul's saying the problem is the only way you can win mass approval the way you're wanting to do is by saying something that the mass wants to hear. And that's going to have to be something that's coming from a different place, having a different picture of reality than the Christian one. Does that answer your question? Does that make sense?
It seems like the goal of those two are radically, radically different in how the Corinthians would define wisdom to be, or a wise person, versus what Paul is. It seems like completely, radically different ideas contained within how both of those people are.
Right. There is something in common that both of them would call it wisdom, because if they're right about the context and about what life is really all about, then this is a powerful and persuasive thing that I ought to embrace. But if Paul's right about the world, that there is a God and we stand before him in the terrible situation that he describes, then the gospel becomes powerful, persuasive wisdom, because it is the message of hope and redemption from that same God. But if that's not the case, then it's kind of missing the point, and we ought to talk about something else.
What do you think he means by just feeding you, you know, spiritually and not
you? Well, we will talk about that passage more later on, because we'll have to get into that. You have to picture, I think, picture Paul is talking to them about what he taught them when he first started the church. He came there, I mean, they weren't believers at all when he started, and a number of them said, yes, we think this is right, we'll join this. And he's talking about the way he chose to talk to them and the kinds of things that he talked to them about. And the concept of milk is very related to what he's talking about there. The notion, the difference between being immature and mature, that there is a place of maturity, I think, where a person has gone through the faith and has had their faith tested and tried enough that they have gotten to where they have sort of settled into, yes, I know what this faith is, this is what I want, this is what my life is about, and there's a kind of a maturity and subtleness in the faith that emerges through experience and through the teaching of God. That it's when a person is in that spot, then with that kind of maturity, they're capable of recognizing the importance of a lot of things that at first a young believer or someone who at least they may be a believer or maybe they're not a believer, but they're saying they are or they've joined the church or whatever, in that situation, they haven't gotten to the spot where they can be very discerning about what they hear or what, you know, what's important and what's not. And so I think what he's talking about is, I'm picturing you when when I was there, I'm seeing people who are basically not mature in the faith, and so I am adjusting my comments, what I'm saying to you, accordingly. And part of the reason he's saying it is, you're judging me for whether I speak wisdom. You have to recognize I was tailoring my comments to my audience. I mean, there's a little bit of an insult in this, and that he's saying basically, you shouldn't be judging how wise I can be in my speech. You should see what I do when I've got an audience that is capable of taking in what I have to say, which was not you. So that, I mean...
I have a question.
Yes.
Would a person, if you met a person and they had a tremendous amount of spiritual knowledge and the insight into that spiritual knowledge, would you label that wisdom? Or if they expressed the value of the knowledge, you know, would that be wisdom?
Well, it could be. I mean, when we're talking about wisdom from a biblical perspective, and now we're talking about the wisdom, I'm talking about here, like, maturity, coming into an understanding, growing into the faith and that sort of thing. It's not so much whether you recognize that wisdom is there or that by what I say or something. The biblical emphasis would be on having that understanding such that, you know, I would look at a situation where maybe I'm being called upon to forgive someone who's done something terrible or I'm going to lose something, but for the sake of the gospel, I feel like it's what I ought to do or something. Wisdom would be that perspective that recognizes this is the right thing to do. I'm not really losing in the end. This is, you know, this is what I'm called to and that sort of thing. So it's not so much being able to articulate theology as it is being able to rightly see what's important. And I think that kind of wisdom is something, as we're going to talk about, that's part of the process that God takes us through and part of the purpose of what the Bible calls trials, is for us to have to kind of, where the rubber meets the road, figure out, what am I about? What do I think is valuable? And that kind of stuff. And a lot of times it's in those circumstances where that kind of wisdom grows. Paul here, though, because that's a little bit different use of wisdom, which the Bible uses a lot, because the issue here is the evaluation of his speech. The issue here is, I'm listening to this proclamation. Is that wisdom or is that wisdom? And they're saying, what you're doing, that's fine, but it's not wisdom, not what I'm looking for. This is not the powerful stuff. So in that sense, in this context, the discussion is about what you say. But more often in the Bible, the wisdom is not so much what you say, but what you understand and embrace and live out. So, okay, did that? Yeah, Terry.
Would your assumption be that Apollos was teaching a false gospel then?
No.
If it's not what Paul's, are they just misinterpreting him? Are they unbalanced?
Maybe unbalanced. We know that Acts commends Apollos as having been helpful to the Corinthians. In the Corinthian letter, at the end, we see that Apollos is with Paul. He has left Corinth, and he is there. And I may just be making this up, but I just have this feeling. It's not necessarily the case, but the Corinthians are saying to Paul, we'd like Apollos back. And Apollos is saying, no, I'm not going to go back right now. And Paul says, so he's not at all ready to come see you. And maybe it's just, you know, he got a job and he just didn't want to leave it for a while or something. That's possible. But I just wonder, he's got to know that the whole church is splitting up and there are people there who are saying, we're on Apollos' team. And I don't think Apollos ever meant to do that. I don't think that's not what he set out to do. But he came in, he's a young guy, he's eloquent. You know, it's got to be a little flattering. People are coming around and saying, wow, we really like what you're doing. And before you know it, Apollos has found himself becoming the kind of the seed that has grown into this awful thing. So I think what's happened, it's not that what Apollos is saying is necessarily bad, but what you see in him, what he's doing, he's not so much spending his time proclaiming a message of sin and justification and that kind of thing. He's spending his time arguing in the marketplace, Jesus is the Christ. And he's winning those debates because he's a good debater. So as I understand it, there are aspects of Greek culture, if you think about the sophists and the way that many would have admired the sophists' ability to win debates and that kind of thing. But I think what they're doing is they're looking at Apollos and saying, yeah, that's great. And they're not embarrassed. You know, they don't mind the proclamation, Jesus is the Christ. They've bought that. They're saying, sure, okay, we believe that, Jesus is the Christ. So to hear Apollos in the marketplace, you know, beaten up rhetorically on the Jews, they say, ah, we love that. That's what we like to see, is somebody out there doing that. But Paul is more speaking to the heart of, if Jesus is the Christ, what does that mean? And what is it about? And it's about the cross, and it's about sin, and our need for redemption, and that stuff. And he's doing it in such a way that you only really are going to be attracted to what he's doing if you're willing to take on the big issues of your own sin and that kind of stuff. So that's how I would see it. I don't think Apollos was saying anything wrong, but what he was doing was a lot easier for people to take, and so a lot more attractive. I can imagine them bringing someone to see him and going, yeah, I got to admit, he's pretty impressive, you know. And you're thinking, oh boy, you know, I'm winning people to our team here because they come and see Apollos and they think he's great. And then Paul comes around and they say, you know, we liked hearing Apollos, but I don't, tell me when another guy comes around because I'm not really interested in that. And so now they're embarrassed. They say, hey, we had him. When they were listening to Apollos, we were getting them. And then Paul spoke up and the whole thing is ruined. So I think it's that kind of thing. And probably in chapter 3 in 1 Corinthians is where we get into this picture of how you build on the foundation. And Paul uses this language like, I planted and Apollos watered and all this kind of stuff. But there's a warning in chapter 3 about you had better be careful how you build on this foundation. And the foundation that he's talking about is Paul laid the foundation. He preached, he established the church in Corinth, he taught the truth, and that's the foundation it was laid on. Then he's saying, whoever comes along after that had better be cautious and make sure that they're building with good materials, which I think is just a little bit kind of just a mild, you know, not that Apollos set out to do anything bad, but this, what he built on this didn't quite work out so well. So I think there's a little bit of a warning to Apollos to be more careful, to not be fomenting factionalism and that kind of thing. But the fact that he's with Paul and everything, I don't think that Paul has anything against him at this point. I think Apollos just sort of, it got out of hand and he didn't know what to do. Maybe he got out of hand, he didn't know what to do and he left. So, you know, I think I'm getting out of here. And at any rate, he's not there then. But that's a good point. We don't want to dump on Apollos. He seemed to have been a good guy. And some people think he wrote the book of Hebrews. Not Jack.
One way to highlight your point, you could imagine Paul being eloquent in the way that Apollos was eloquent and still writing this chapter. Yes. If they responded to him with kind of flattery for, boy, you're really wise, Paul, and he sensed that the sort of wisdom they were responding to was their own wisdom, he'd still write this chapter.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not that Paul is saying Apollos shouldn't have been doing that. And I think you're right. Paul could have done the same thing. And it doesn't seem that he was as eloquent as Apollos. But if he had been, I think you're absolutely right. It wouldn't have changed anything he's saying here. Now, I don't think he was. And if you read 2 Corinthians, in the later part of 2 Corinthians, is where Paul specifically speaks to this issue. And I don't know if you've ever read it, but he talks in there about they say his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech is contemptible. That's Paul describing how they talk about him. So that evidently he was not, you know, the most charismatic speaker that you ever came across in one sense. He was the most charismatic speaker you ever come across in another sense. Anything else? Yes.
On Sunday, David was talking about Islam, and Muhammad thought that he was hearing from God, and what he heard from God was obviously different than what Paul is saying he heard from God.
Yes.
So, how do we know he's right?
Right. That's a very good question. I think that it's not a simple answer to that. I mean, I think you're right. Implicit in your question is a kind of a warning to us that just because somebody says God told me so doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. So how would I know that I ought to take Paul seriously on this? For myself, the way I would answer that is, as I look at the picture in the Bible, it seems to me that a number of things come together. One is Paul is appealing back to the Old Testament, to the revelation that was already there of God that he had made of himself to Israel. And there is continuity and coherence between Paul's message and what it had been revealed up to that point. Part of it is, we saw in here, he used the language about the power of the Spirit, the Spirit and that stuff. In 2 Corinthians, there are people there who are actually questioning whether Paul is an apostle at all. And one of the things he says to them is the signs of an apostle were done among you, meaning that part of what's happening is that God is testifying through miraculous activity that he is behind what's going on. Just as Jesus did miracles, and in the Gospel of John keeps referring to them as signs. It's like they're messages saying, this is in fact my son. You need to be listening to him. But it's not just because of the miracles, it's also because the message that is being proclaimed deserves to be heard. It's not coming along and saying, oh, all of that stuff was wrong, I've got a new thing for you here, but it is consistent and coherent with what God had already been saying. So the combination of the compelling nature of the message that's being proclaimed, together with the miraculous attestation that God is behind it, all of that seems to me to come together. Part of the reason that I don't find some other religious traditions, I mean, take Mormonism or Islam or things that are essentially, I would say, they are Christian heresies. Christianity, the Bible is already in place, and people are saying, well, we can go one better than that. And as I look at it, there is no, Islam makes a claim to be revering, you know, Abraham, and they would make a place for Jesus and all that kind of stuff. But the place they're making is not the place that the Bible makes for them. So you have this message that's saying, well, we're basically in keeping with that. But then I look at it and say, well, but you're basically not. So I have a hard time putting those things together. So all of that, I think, has to come together. As well as, some of it is just a personal odyssey that we're going to go through, I think. I mean, there is a certain subjective element to all of our decisions about this. We can't get away from that. I mean, personal to me, I have to decide what I'm going to do about this. And I know in my own experience, part of what got me to the place that I am now is my coming to the place where I realized that the reason I wasn't a Christian was because I didn't want to be. That it was not because it wasn't compelling or I couldn't make a good case for it being true, but because I didn't want, I found myself saying to people, I don't want God to come along and interfere with my life. And afterwards, I would have to go away and think about that and say, boy, that's kind of a strange thing to say. I mean, I had to think, you know, here I am, I'm accusing Christians of being naive and just believing what they want to believe, and yet here I am saying that I don't believe it because I don't want to. That's not the way it's supposed to work. I mean, you're supposed to believe stuff whether when it's true, even if you don't want to believe it. So part of it is, in a way, was in that message, I find myself looking at the hardest thing to swallow that I'm going to have to ever face and realizing that's part of what's compelling about this message is I go to those over there, I don't have to swallow as much. Right here is where I confront what I know about myself and what I have to deal with. So there's that subjective element too. Yes?
Well, otherwise someone would think Islam or Christianity for out of ease, because Islam is much harder religion than Christianity is. Commitment.
I didn't hear the first part of what you said.
Well, I was thinking you're saying like someone would choose other religions over Christianity because Christianity is harder or whatever the person. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's true of Islam. Islam is a lot harder religion than Christianity.
Well, no, it depends on what you mean by hard. I had a different concept in mind.
Okay.
I mean, I'm no expert on Islam, but from what I have seen, see, there are many religions around that are very rigorous, and Islam is rigorous, and there are others that are rigorous. They ask a lot of me. To be a practitioner, I have to do a lot of things. But I understand the great spiritual disease to be self-righteousness. And there's something, after I've done all of that rigorous stuff, there can be something very attractive and comforting about being able to tell myself, I did all that stuff when these other folks over here didn't. The hard part about Christianity is swallowing my pride, is coming before God and saying, you know, there isn't anything I could do to earn my place before you or to make myself better than anybody else. I mean, I just can't get there. So it's spiritually harder, I guess, is what I'm saying. It calls on me to confront a more fundamental issue. That's what I was getting at. Anything else?
I have a quick question about verse 1.
Yes.
In chapter 2 of Corinthians.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about the two types of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So like in verse, I think 6, I think it says, I have the King James Version, howbeit we speak wisdom among them that are perfect, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor of the princes of this world that come to naught, but we speak the wisdom of God in the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you were thinking in verse 1 at which wisdom that is, if he's saying we don't speak the wisdom of men, or we don't speak the same wisdom that we speak among the mature, or among the perfect, because you Corinthians are so carnal or fleshly.
I think I got lost a little bit. I should have looked while you were doing it. I thought I knew what you were talking about, and then I got... So, because what you were quoting from is not verse 1, right?
Well, verse 1, but then also verse 6, just to compare the two types of wisdom.
Okay. So I'm sorry, but would you do it again?
Yeah,
would you say what?
I'll read verse 1 as well.
Okay.
And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God... Then verse 2, for I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. So I'm wondering in verse 1, along with the excellency of speech or of wisdom, what kind of wisdom?
Right. Right. I think it's the way he's been using it throughout chapter 1. It's this wisdom in quotation marks. It's what they would call wisdom. It starts in chapter 1, verse 17. In the New American Standard, what it says is, but for Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, is what I have in numeric standard, but literally what it says is wisdom of word or wisdom of speech. So he did not send me to preach in wisdom of speech. And what he means by wisdom, of course, Christ did send him to preach in wisdom of speech, if you define wisdom rightly. But there is this thing that the Corinthians would call wisdom. And what he's saying is he didn't send me to speak with what you call wisdom. So wisdom, throughout that section, he's going back and forth between what you call wisdom and what God would call wisdom. So in verse 1 of chapter 2, I did not come to you with superiority of speech or of wisdom. That would be what you call wisdom. But then in 6, we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. That's what God would call wisdom. So that is tricky as you go through here. He keeps going back and forth between a positive sense of wisdom and a negative sense of wisdom. Because they have a wisdom with which they want him to speak. But it's not, it is worldliness. They consider it to be wise because it's an attractive message that a lot of people will respond to. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. It's just verse 2, I guess, that I would... How does that connect in with that if he's just preaching Christ crucified, which seems like a really... like basic message to the Corinthians rather than I guess the wisdom that he speaks among the perfect or mature. I guess I was comparing those two.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I missed what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah, there are a couple of ways to go with that, and I go back and forth as to how to connect verse 2 and verse 6. One obvious way, when you read it, is kind of the direction that I kind of hear hinted at in your question is, all right, when he was with the Corinthians, he decided he wasn't going to talk about anything except, you know, so Paul, someone comes to question Paul with a question about, Paul, I don't understand this justification by faith stuff. Could we talk about that? And Paul says, no, Jesus was crucified on the cross for your sins. That's all I have to say. As if he would just narrowed it in and that's all he's going to talk about, and it's only with the mature that he talks about more theologically profound things or something like that. I'm inclined against that, although it's possible. I think what he means is that when he was with them, he was only preaching Jesus Christ and him crucified, which is a message that has all sorts of ramifications and things that you could talk about with it. But he was not interested in anything that was either tangential or, what's more important, at odds with that. He did not come to speak what they would have found to be compelling and wise. He came to put the emphasis on the cross and the implications of the cross and what that means for us, and that was his message. And when he talks about speaking wisdom among those who are mature, to a certain extent, I think what he's implying is it is the mature who will recognize the wisdom in what it is that I'm saying. Now, he does imply in here that I couldn't speak to you later, I couldn't speak to you as spiritual people, that in a certain sense, he would have spoken a little differently to them if he had felt he was speaking to a mature group. But I don't think he's meaning to imply really strongly that I'm just very narrowly focusing in on this. What he's really trying to get across to them is my message focused on the very thing that is most offensive. In chapter 1, he's been saying this over and over again. The wisdom of the world, this is not compatible with the wisdom of the cross. The cross, those who understand what true wisdom is, recognize the cross as the center of what's really wise. That's the stuff that's the profound stuff. So that's what I was determined to teach among you. Not what you would have found wise, but what I found to be at the center of wisdom. And I think that fundamentally that's what he's trying to say to them. if that makes any sense. It's a challenging question. It's a good question. It's a very good question.
Isn't the maturity, when you say you have a certain level, if you reach another level of maturity, isn't that same thing, the same with Islam, you reach a certain level and then you can feel good about that level, and it's the same type of thing. You're not believing based on faith anymore, because you're partially faith, but it also is because you've reached a certain level, you've done something to get to there. Because there's faith in the other religions too, in Islam and Hinduism and that stuff too.
Right. I'm not sure that I understand what you're saying.
Well, it's still like different levels to it. You're talking about maturity. They've reached another level. Because of their works, they've reached another level.
Yeah, well, that I'm going to talk a lot about that particular topic. I think I have miscommunicated. I don't think I would lay claim to what you said I said. So, but we'll see later on. Well, let's stop at that then, and we'll pick it up next week. Thanks for coming.